Okay, Kilo Golf 7, Golf Delta Bravo here. Switch my machine on here so I can actually read. Hang on. Okay, good evening. Welcome everyone to the 529 Emergency Preparedness Net. This is courtesy of the WA7ABU 529 repeater. This is Kilo Golf 7, Golf Delta Bravo. My name's Brett, and I'm net control for today, May 19th, 2020. This net meets each Tuesday evening from 7 to 8 p.m. local time on 145.29 megahertz. This is a designated emergency frequency, so we'll break if any real emergency occurs. Our alternate frequency is 145.19 with a tone of 100. We appreciate those who stand by and allow us to have clear frequency for the next hour as we discuss emergency preparedness with particular emphasis on the COVID-19 pandemic. We have special guest Sheila Sund, MD, tonight, who will answer your questions about COVID-19. All amateur operators are welcome to participate in COVID-19 discussions during the net. Just a reminder that there's a lot of political stuff going on. This is more on the scientific and medical preparedness aspects, less on the political ramifications of COVID-19. So anyway, what we're going to do is have a short check-in period, and if you can let me know if you're going to have a question, I can highlight you and we'll come back to you. When you check in, I would like you to use your call sign slowly and phonetically, and also your name and your location. It'll be a controlled net, and if I don't get through you in the first little few minutes here, you can check in later if you have a question, and I just want to get through any questions that we have here. Okay, let's start with anybody who was on the EchoLink system would like to check in for the emergency preparedness COVID discussion. Come now, please. Okay, hearing no one on EchoLink, let's take general check-ins for the emergency preparedness net. Go now.
Hello, Brett. W7 November Alpha Tango, Nate, South Salem.
Kilo Echo 7, Oscar Lima, Uniform Paul, north of Beaverton at Forest Heights.
Kilo 7, Romeo Tango Lima, Rick, South Salem.
Kilo India 7, Sierra Oscar, X-ray, Jane, Salem.
K-6, Sierra Tango, X-ray, Dan Kaiser.
Kilo 7, Romeo Tango Kilo, Ron in Wilsonville.
November Whiskey 7, Oscar Romeo, and November 7, Delta Kilo Bravo, Richard and Deborah in Albany.
Kilo 7, Alpha Romeo Tango, Art and Canby.
Kilo Foxtrot 6, Foxtrot Yankee Delta, Richard Salem.
Checked in. Anyway, let me just go back to the list here and work my way back up here. Kilo 7, Alpha Romeo Tango, Art, got you. Richard and Deborah, November Whiskey 7, Oscar Romeo, November 7, Delta Kilo Bravo, got you. But right before that, I had a Hotel Delta Foxtrot, and you're not Norm, so you need to get, you might be Norm, but you're not Norm, that's not your name. So let's come back with that Hotel Delta Foxtrot and get you in the log here.
Hey, Brad, this is Kilo Juliet 7, Hotel Delta Foxtrot, Jeremy in Salem.
Kilo Foxtrot 6, Foxtrot Yankee Delta, Richard, Salem.
Jeremy in there first. This is Kilo Juliet 7, Hotel Delta Foxtrot. Richard, you snuck in there. Good. Kilo Foxtrot 6, Foxtrot Yankee Delta. And we also had, before that, let me make sure we get rid of this one. This is not the other, wrong, Hotel Delta Foxtrot. Okay. And we had Richard in there, let's see, Whiskey 0, Echo Delta Foxtrot. We had, I think, Ron, Kilo 7, Romeo Tango Kilo. You're new to my log tonight, Ron, from Wilsonville. We had K6 Sierra Tango X-Ray, Dan. Kilo India 7 Sierra Oscar X-Ray, that's Jay. Kilo 7 Romeo Tango Lima, that's Rick. Kilo Echo 7 Oscar Lima Uniform, Paul. And Nate started that group off Whiskey 7 November Alpha Tango. Okay, I'll take a few more check-ins.
Good evening, Brett. Kilo 5, Charlie, Papa, Charlie, Mike, and Happy Valley.
Kilo India 7, Foxtrot Whiskey Hotel, Alan. And Kilo India 7, Foxtrot Whiskey Papa, Jennifer, South Salem.
Okay, very good. There's Kilo India 7, Foxtrot Whiskey Papa, Jennifer, and Kilo India 7, Foxtrot Whiskey Hotel, Alan, and Mike. Kilo 5, Charlie, Papa, Charlie, up on the hill in Happy Valley. Okay, that's 16 of us. Let me pause there and see if anybody has any announcements for the net. I want to get into the discussion so we have plenty of time to answer questions. And we think we have a critical mass of people here. Any announcements for the net? Okay, I'm not hearing anybody. I did see that they're not going to have an Oktoberfest Hamfest. I don't know if anybody announced that today, but that affects a lot of you guys. So no Oktoberfest in Rick Rial in October this year. So keep up with the Saturday Night Swap Net on this frequency. So if you have your equipment, that's going to be one of your outlets for that. Anyway, okay, well, let's move on here. We're going to go ahead and introduce Sheila Sund, MD. She's our local retired physician who spends lots and lots of time reading about COVID-19 so that she can answer your questions. And so we're going to go ahead and hand it over to her and let her introduce the topic tonight. And a lot of stuff has happened in the last 2 weeks. So let's get started here. Here's Sheila.
Hello, everybody. I'm thinking maybe some of you have decided to venture out, even though Marion County and the Portland area are not technically open. So let's talk a little bit about what you should be thinking about if you decide to take advantages of Oregon's reopening. First of all, I want to refer to the actual statement from Kate Brown, Governor, on the reopening guidance. Number 2 on her general guidance is to avoid exposure to COVID-19. People who are at risk for severe complications, anyone over the age of 60 or having underlying medical conditions, should still stay home even if you feel well. In other words, it doesn't matter what is open or not open. If you're over age 60 or if you have underlying medical conditions, nothing has really changed. The state, as well as all the docs and all the experts, are still recommending that you stay home. I suspect a lot of you have been looking at the newspaper articles and thinking, hey, I get to go to the restaurant, I get to go to the bar, I get to get my hair cut. It's important to realize the recommendations have not changed whatsoever if you are over that age group or you have underlying health conditions. So, despite that, let's also talk about if you decide to go out, what does that mean? Well, first of all, I can tell you in Oregon, I looked at what our numbers are now compared to what they were like back on March 23rd when we put the stay-at-home orders in there. At this point in time, we have a lot more active infections than we did at that point in time, so your risk is actually higher than it was when we first went to stay-down orders. We in Marion County particularly have been having a fairly significant outbreak, probably mostly in agricultural communities. But the reality is that it's no safer out there now than it was when we first got nervous of this back in March. And in fact, it's probably less safe out there now than it was when we first got nervous about this back in March. So what that means, if you venture out, is that the rules have not changed. You need to be as cautious as you ever were. Let's go back to contaminated surfaces. That's still a major source of infection. And if we've been staying home for a long time, if you're like me, you've probably gotten a little bit lazy because you're not that exposed. So reminder, if you go outside and touch anything outside of your home environment, the best thing is to wash your hands for at least 20 seconds or to use a hand sanitizer. If you're thinking about using a public bathroom, you have to balance the need for hand washing against how many people are in the bathroom and how much time. You should have your car kit still with disinfectant wipes or spray. You need to have your hand sanitizer in the car, your hand washing kit if you're not going to use public bathrooms, and paper towels. If you venture out, don't forget that you start to need disinfecting things after use. Your car and truck handles, your steering wheel, other high-touch surfaces. If you use credit cards, you might want to hand them to a person and take them back via a disinfecting wipe. You're going to have to start washing the surfaces of your house entrances, like knobs and lights and counters, etc. And that includes your cell phone if you used it with potentially dirty hands that have touched the outside environment. You still need to have that hot zone at home. Anything that touched the outside world, like purses, grocery bags, packages, etc., can't come into your house until they've been disinfected. And these days, we also have to have a good plan for masks if you venture out. You take the mask off carefully without shaking it. You put it in a safe, enclosed surface, and you don't touch it again until it's washed. So that's the rules that were there before. They're still there, but we need to remember them if we're going to go out and start touching things again. The other thing that I want to talk about more that's going to really influence whether I go out, and I'm over 60, so I probably won't do it that much, is, again, this concept of aerosolized droplets. All the studies are showing a definite risk from the possibility of inhaling virus particles. And I can tell you, looking at all the rules and regulations for reopening, most of them are not taking that adequately into consideration. I can't tell you exactly what's safe and what's not, but what you have to look to every time you walk into a space that's enclosed. Outside, you can do whatever you want as long as you keep a 6-foot distance. Inside, you need to look at the size of the airspace, including how high the ceiling is, as well as the square feet. If it's a smaller space, if there is COVID in there, it's going to be at a higher concentration, more chance of breathing in enough to get you in trouble. You need to look at the air circulation within that space. Air movement speeds virus dispersion, and it also dries up the aerosolized particles and makes them fall to the ground or surfaces. So air movement, particularly if it's fresh air, open windows, things like that, that's good. A room that doesn't have a lot of noticeable air movement in it, that's bad. More likely to have virus floating around, okay? You also have to pay a little bit of attention to directional air movement. They've done a couple nice studies of things like Chinese restaurants and call centers where they could literally measure how virus moved from one table to another or one cubicle to another based upon the flow of the air conditioning unit above their heads. So standing in a directional air path is probably not the best idea. But again, you have to look at air circulation within your space, size of the airspace. Then you have to look at how many other people have been sharing that same airspace, either at the same time as you or in the hour or two before you went in there. The more people that have been there in the hour or two before you, the higher the risk. The more time each of them has spent in the room, the greater the risk. How long has it been since they were in the room? If you had five people in there 5 minutes ago, the risk is a lot higher than five people an hour and a half ago. You also need to be paying attention to what people are doing in the room. We know that aerosolized droplets depend upon activity. If you're sitting silently in a corner, you're probably not putting out much air aerosolized droplets. If you're talking, you put out some. If you're speaking in a loud voice or yelling, you put out more. And as you keep going, if you're singing, you're putting out quite a lot. If you're heavy breathing, like at the gym, you're putting out a lot. And if you're coughing and sneezing, you're basically doing a machine gun into the room. So you have to be thinking about what are people doing in the same space, airspace that you're in. And then finally, you have to think about how long you're going to be in the room. If you're going in and out of a space in just the, 2 minutes, running in and picking something up, even if it's a pretty small space and pretty contaminated, you're probably going to be okay. On the other hand, if you sit in there for an hour or two drinking or eating dinner, you are going to have plenty of time to breathe in what virus is there. So a shorter time in a shared airspace is always going to be safer. So with that, if I were to venture out, I would tell you my comfort level. I am completely happy doing anything outdoors with 6 foot distancing. And I don't mind if I pass within 6 feet briefly, if I pass somebody on a trail, if I'm putting food on the table, picking something up, hey, I can pass within their clouds for, less than a minute and not feel nervous. But in an indoor space, I will only go there if it's a large airspace with a controlled number of people inside, like a grocery store, maybe a Home Depot. I will try to spend less than 15 minutes there. If it requires me to be there longer, I will only go in if I have an N95 mask. Maybe a surgical mask, definitely not a cloth mask. If I have to go into a smaller airspace, I might use a mask for going in there for 5 minutes. I won't go over there for longer than 15 minutes, unless literally it's kind of like life and health dependent. I do not feel like risking my life so I can go to a restaurant or do wine tasting again. And so that's my approach to social distancing. And with that, I will open it up to questions and comments.
Okay, and this is Kilo Golf 7 Golf Delta Bravo for ID. You have any questions for Dr. Sund?
Okay, 6 year Tango X-ray.
Okay, Dan, you're first. Go ahead.
Okay, we got a little problem. A dentist. I have an appointment with a dentist here within a week, and a podiatrist, which has been put off twice now already, and kind of needs to be taken care of. So what about those kind of arrangements?
There are going to be things that you have to put yourself at risk for. I have a dental appointment for cleaning. I'm not going to go. But if I had a sore tooth that was running a risk at getting abscessed or falling out or leading to a root canal or a crown, I'd probably have to bite the bullet and go into the dentist. I'd probably relook at who my dentist is, okay? I used to have a dentist where I went in, it was very small, and there was just me and the dentist and a hygienist. I liked that. The more recent dentist I've been using, there's like 4 chairs and 4 hygienists and 2 dentists and 2 or 3 office people all in the same space. I don't want to go back there. So I'm actually thinking about changing dentists until COVID is over because I don't want to go to that space. But if I had a sore tooth, I would, and it was really urgent, I'd even go to them. But in the meantime, I'd start planning ahead, and I am starting to plan ahead, about how I can find a dentist with the lowest number of people in the space. I will go in only when they're ready to put me in the chair. I would expect them to be masked all the time, not just when they're breathing in my face, but all the time in that office. I would like seeing disinfecting all over the place. And again, personally, I would like to have a surgical or an N95 mask on right up to the moment that I have to take it off for them to put their hands in my mouth, and I'd put it back on again afterwards. And so I'm at the point where I'm starting to pull out the couple of N95s that I've had hidden. And I can tell you I was recently in Los Angeles, and I was seeing them down there. So I think it's a little more socially acceptable to use them in select circumstances like that.
Okay, thank you, Dan. Good question there. I know actually Rick is out there who is a dentist. Rick, do you have any comments or about going to the, what have you done to protect yourself and your patients?
Yeah, thanks. I quite a few thoughts. So I'll try to make them brief. We actually did a two-hour orientation. We're doing 15 levels of protection in regards to that, cutting down our patient load to 50. I work in a clinic with a lot of offices, and I mean a lot of operatories and a lot of people, and we've cut them down to 50%. We left the chair rest for 30 minutes to 2 hours. People do not, there's only one person in the reception room. There used to be like 10 or 12. They wait out in their cars, and we call them to come in. We use N95 and face shields whenever we're using aerosol spray, you know, anytime we're drilling, taking off bonding cement. 15 different layers that we're following, including pre-screening, re-screening, and then asking them the same questions again, fever, chills, breathing difficulty, coughing. So even though it's a big clinic, we do a lot of things to minimize the risk. K7RTL.
And that's actually a really good example. I mean, I think the first thing we should all be looking at is if we have to go somewhere, is the business or the clinic or the whatever, are they following the rules as well as they possibly can? And it sounds like you guys are. You didn't mention whether you all wear masks the entire time that you are in the office or whether you're just wearing a mask when you are, actually doing the procedures. If you're not wearing masks continuously, I would encourage that, maybe not N95s, but at least some type of mask for all of your employees whenever they're in the clinic. And make sure it covers their nose. I've been amazed at how many employees I see in places that they pull down the mask below their nose. But it is important that we look at how well the businesses we're going to frequent are following the rules. And if they're following the rules, then it becomes a matter of you having to make your own personal choices for your own safety. But if a business isn't following the rules, don't go there. I mean, seriously, don't allow them to endanger you. Don't allow them to endanger the employees if they're not following the rules. And if you don't have a copy of what the rules are, let me know. I've collected all of them as they've been put out. And so sounds like his clinic's doing great, as good as you can be in that situation. And if you got to go to the dentist, that's what you want.
Yeah, thank you, Sheila, and thanks for doing this. You got very practical, real information. We wear masks, regular masks, not N95s, but all the time, walking the halls, and our receptionists constantly have them on. Occasionally take them off to breathe when we're at our computer, and then a lot of disinfection.
What we're talking about tonight. Any other questions? This is Kilo Golf 7 Golf Delta Bravo. We have the Emergency Preparedness Net. And if you haven't checked in, that's fine. You can check in with a question as well.
W7NAT.
Yes, go ahead, Nate.
For those who are looking for N95 masks, you might check in your garage or wherever you keep these things. They're in the emergency preparedness area. Look around in there and see if you can't find some of those things. I have, and I've found them.
That's exactly where I had. I used to run Marion County's Medical Reserve Corps, and so I had a couple N95s stashed away in my medical go bag that's in my car at all times. So I pulled those out. I also knew that this was coming in January, and so I bought some extra N95s. I couldn't even get healthcare ones then, but I bought regular, construction level N95s back in January. So I've got a stash of about, I don't know, 6 or 8, mostly from, your emergency supplies. I did want to point out something with an N95, because I think if you have one and you have to use it, save it for when you have to go into a small space that you're going to feel more nervous about. Don't bother to use it when you go to the grocery store, those kinds of things. It's just going to wear out. But if you have to go to some place that's making you nervous, that's the time to pull out that N95 if you have one in your emergency supplies. But it is important to realize that your N95 is not going to work as well as, say, a orthodontist or a dentist who has been fitted for the N95, because there's a lot of N95s out there, and not everyone fits every face. So when you need it for your occupation, they actually make you do something called a fit test to make sure it really fits correctly. But you can do at least a mini test, and that's called a seal check. And anybody, even if they've had a fit test, is supposed to do this with an N95 every time they put it on. So when you put your N95 on, you put your mask on, you put the top little elastic thing should go above your ears, the bottom elastic thing should go below your ears, they shouldn't cross. You want to make sure you tighten the metal band around your nose as tightly as it can. Then you put your hands over the mask so that it is little air is going through it as possible from the outside. And then you want to try and puff a little bit of air out from your mouth. And if your N95 is reasonably well fit, you should feel like a positive pressure build up inside, and you shouldn't have a lot of air leak out around the sides. That's what tells you that your N95 mask is really working well. So it's a quick little test. You might not be able to adjust it to do that, but it's worth a try of playing with your elastics, playing with the nose band, playing with the position to try and get as much of that seal of an N95 as possible, because that's part of what makes it better than a regular surgical mask.
Okay, and this is Kilo Golf 7, Golf Delta Bravo. We have the emergency prepares net. We have Sheila Sund, MD here, answering questions for you about COVID-19. And does anybody else have a question or check in or come now, please?
Kilo India 7, Sierra Oscar X-ray.
KK7 ART. Kilo Alpha 7, Uniform Quebec Oscar.
Okay, hold on just a second. Kilo Alpha 7, Uniform Quebec Oscar. Did I get that call sign right?
That's affirmative. An infiltrator from Canby, Clackamas County.
Okay, so yeah, Gerald, is that what you go by, or is it Jerry, or what's your handle?
It's Jerry, Juliet, Echo, Romeo, Romeo, Yankee, K7UQO.
Okay, Jerry, you're new to my log there. Did you have a question, too, tonight, or are you just checking in?
Just rolling through the channels and listening to what's going on. Pretty interesting conversation, so I thought I'd chime in. K7UQO.
Okay, very good. Let's see. Now, let me just hang in there. We're answering questions about COVID-19. We've got Art, I think, was first. Go ahead, Art.
Yeah, thank you. So I see lots of people wearing masks with valves. Am I correct to assume that those are completely useless for keeping the public safe in general? I know they make it more comfortable if you're sanding wood in a hot environment, but I don't think they're any good for containing any kind of viral discharge from people, and I was just wondering your thoughts on that. Thank you. TK7ART.
It really depends on whether that valve is part of an N95 or a NIOSH-approved mask. A lot of the N95s are mitten with a valve, and by the way, if you're wearing one of those, instead of doing a positive pressure seal where you puff out and see if the air stays in, instead you do a negative pressure seal where you suck in and see if it kind of sucks to your face when it has a valve. So if it is an official valve because it's an N95 mask, yeah, they're actually designed to keep out all the bad things, whether that was fumes from the construction or viruses or whatever. Again, that depends upon whether the mask is fitting correctly otherwise. I don't know, however, people may have been adding valves to non-N95 masks, and if it's not an N95 mask with a valve, I wouldn't think it's probably doing all that much good. But honestly, I haven't seen any, so I don't really know. Most of the ones that I've seen with valves are actually N95s. And so, therefore, the valve has been designed to do its job.
Okay, thank you, Art. Now, we had Jay in there, right? Kilo India 7, Sierra Oscar X-ray. Go ahead.
Yeah, I've got a third party, my YL, with a question, if that's okay.
Absolutely. Go ahead.
Joseph Fair, virologist and NBC contributor, thinks he got the coronavirus on a flight, a very full flight, airplane flight, wearing a mask and gloves and wiping down everything on a flight that had already been supposedly cleaned. So he believes he got the virus through his eyes. Now, can you get the virus through your eyes just by being in the air, not necessarily touching your eye, but just being in the airspace of the virus?
I haven't read of any transmission via the eyes with just airspace. We do know that if you get splashed in your eyes, that you can, like if somebody coughs in your eyes, sneezes in your eyes, or for healthcare, if they're intubating somebody or doing a nasal swab test, that those kinds of level of droplets in the eyes can potentially cause infection, and that's why you're seeing healthcare workers are now often wearing these plastic shields in front of their whole faces. They used to wear goggles, but those aren't available anymore, so they've developed these plastic shields to protect their eyes. Probably something dentists and orthodontists should probably be thinking about as well. But so far, I've not seen anything about people just getting it from virus floating in the room as an aerosol and landing in the eyes. So if it's happening, that's probably pretty rare. I would worry more that it was, if somebody got infected in his setting, that his N95 mask was not fitted as well as it should be.
Kilo Golf 7, Golf Delta Bravo. Just to clarify, was that an airplane flight that you were citing? Again, we were talking about small air spaces, so they circulate the air, and how long do you stay in that airspace? So those are the exposes you again and again to the air circulation. And was it an airplane?
It was a flight from New York to New Orleans. And
yeah, in that setting, I would be pretty concerned that it's just a mask failure. We tend to think of N95 as interchangeable. I mean, you could just go buy them at Home Depot or Lowe's. But again, if you have to actually wear an N95 for your job, like you're an infectious disease guy that works with bad things all the time, or you work with toxic chemicals, they literally make you go into occupational medicine. They put these different masks on you, and then they put this thing over your head, and they put little tiny bits of smell and see if you can smell things that would take only a couple of molecules to get through. And only if you can't smell under these really controlled circumstances do they consider that you have a truly, quote, fit N95. Obviously, none of us are doing that when we buy our own N95s. We're buying what we can get or what we have in our kits. So I think they are still better than a standard surgical mask, which is night and day better than a cloth mask. But it doesn't mean that a non-fit N95 is going to be 100% effective.
I'd add one quick follow-up, if that's okay.
Okay. Richard, let's let that sounds like Jay had a follow-up real quick, and then we'll do Richard. Go ahead, Jay.
Yeah, I'm just wondering if the N95s are reusable, and if they are reusable, how many times can you reuse them, or can you clean them? Back to that.
Well, most N95s were originally designed to not be reusable, that they were disposable, although there are some fancy-dancy ones that were originally designed for reuse. But nobody's been able to not reuse them. What I can tell you is in order to reuse it, you have to keep it clean. I discovered that after I put makeup on and then realized I had makeup on my N95 mask, and if you have any dirt, it won't be disinfectable. So I ruined one N95 mask with makeup. Similar, if it gets dirty in any other way, even you're not going to be able to clean it or disinfect it. As far as if you have a clean N95 that you've worn, how can you disinfect it? Well, if you were one of those people that had a UV disinfecting unit that we talked about, a number of weeks ago, that's safe. You could use one of those. I'm putting mine outside in the bright sunshine, and I'm kind of rotating it like I would do something on the grill, because I do know that sunshine does kill the virus, so I take my N95 out on a hot, sunny day, and I make sure that all the surfaces are exposed to the sunshine for half an hour. I also am very careful with that N95 that it doesn't get wet, doesn't get dirty. As soon as I take it off, it goes into a bag, and that's an important thing to realize. If you have a mask that you've been wearing, and then you take it off and you shove it in the car or your purse or whatever, if it did have virus on it, you've now shoved virus in there, so we all need to be a little bit more careful about how we handle our masks. So I'm trying sunlight because we do know that sunlight kills it, so that's what I'm trying. I don't know how well it works. Haven't run a study on it. I'm just hoping for the best because I've only got a couple N95s.
Okay, Kilo Golf 7, Golf Delta Bravo. We have Richard, EDF, on deck, and I'll go ahead and repeat your question since you're probably the one recording tonight. Okay, just to repeat that question for the recording there, Richard's asking about two styles of mask. One is a pleated mask versus a dust-type bubble mask, and they seem to fit differently, and asked an opinion on a comparison of those two. Here's Sheila.
Well, in there, and we have the problem with why any mask besides an N95 that fits you is not perfect because they're all going to leak in some way or another. An accordion mask has a better prevention of virus and other contaminants going through the substance of the mask. The accordion masks work better for that, but they don't, in most cases, fit as well around the edges, whereas a dust mask fits better around the edges but probably isn't as good at keeping out the small particles that go through it. Both, again, are better than probably a cloth mask. Both don't work if they get dirty or damp. So it's really kind of a question. If you have one of the accordion ones that doesn't have a piece of wire around the nose, a nose piece, I've read that you can actually take like a paper clip and tape it or sew it in place so that you can bend it, because that's where most of the leakage comes from an accordion mask, is up by your nose. So the tighter you can get affixed by your nose, the better it is. But none of them are going to be perfect, which is why you still have to avoid airspace problems in terms of where you choose to go.
Okay, again, this is Kilo Golf 7, Golf Delta Bravo. We're taking COVID-19 questions with Sheila Sun, MD. Anybody else have a question? You're not quite making the repeater there, I'm sorry to say. You have to try moving to a different spot or increasing power, I think.
Kilo 7, Mike Juliet Bravo, Michael.
Okay, Michael, we got you there that time. Kilo 7, Mike Juliet Bravo. Did you have a question?
Yeah.
Okay, that time we lost you again. So, going to have to, again, if you got a handheld, make sure you're standing in front of an east-facing window or toward Silverton, because we're not picking you up very well.
Kilo 7, Mike Julius Bravo. Yeah, I have a question.
Okay, heard you that time. Stand still. Go ahead.
Yes. I was going through a drive-thru. So, I will park here. And, yes, my question, and I have been talking with my doctor through email on this several times. And the big press in the news today was the use of hydrochloroquine. I have been on the internet for 2 hours now, found at least seven different articles on the use of hydrochloroquine in early stages of the virus and how it blocks everything. And I am really wanting, because I have existing conditions, I want to be sure and have that before I take any trips or anything and get on that dose. So, if I have to, I will go to the court, but there's been proven studies all over Europe that this stuff works. How does, and I know it's a 60-year-old drug, so what else? What does she feel?
Well, without actually knowing what you're referring to, I can only tell you what I've read. And so what I do is I actually go to the medical literature. There is a number of places that you can search the international medical literature, as well as a number of places that are putting out preliminary research right now. And I have yet to find, and despite a lot of looking, I have yet to find anything that shows a benefit of it. And I have found some things that show there is a risk. There is a theoretical reason to think that hydroxychloroquine would happen from an action of how it affects cells in the lab, but in all the good clinical studies, meaning studies that meet reasonable scientific and statistical criteria, there has not been any benefit shown, and there have been definitely studies that have shown some problems with cardiac complications, particularly when used in older people. And so, from the medical point of view, the people that are actually looking at PubMed, most of us have yet to find anything convincing that it is actually beneficial in any of the controlled scientific studies.
Yet one doctor in France, 750 patients over the age of 65, one death out of 750.
Okay, is that the French study that you're referring to?
Yeah, the French and Spain. Spain has over 500 patients and one doctor and no death. Like I say, I've looked up seven of them. Italy is pushing over 1,000 patients now by three doctors in the clinic, and they have like five or six deaths out of, and all these are elderly.
Again, if you want to send Brett or give Brett the references that you're specifically talking to, I might be glad to look at them and comment on them. I just looked up one that came out just 5 days ago from France in the British Medical Journal. I haven't done enough. I'm just skimming it right now, so I can't look at the statistical validity of it. But they tested, 181 patients, 18 to 80 years old, who had severe disease, not just early disease. And they said the results of the study do not support its use in patients admitted to the hospital. Now, that's not talking about early patients, but it's looking at sick patients. So that's the kind of articles I'm looking for, and I'd be glad to review the articles if you want to give me references. But so far in my review, I haven't come across them when I'm actually looking at the journals. But that doesn't mean I'm not missing them. I'd be glad to look at the actual articles if you give them to me.
Yeah, those are just three that I remember off the top of my head. Yeah, and a small sample one is not it's not necessarily, we know numbers are numbers. My email is my call sign at yahoo.com, and I can email links.
Okay, Mike, that's good. So you can also send me the send it to me, okay? So go ahead and send it to Kilo Golf 7 Golf Delta Bravo at ARRL.net, and I'll just forward it to her there. So she'd be glad to look at it for you. It's really hard to sort through these things, but it is good that you're looking at the actual studies. That's the most important thing, that because it turns out that when you look at the media reports will kind of change the wording of stuff and say, you know, lots of things. Like there was a new one came out, it says 8 patients, we have a vaccine, and that's kind of interesting because it doesn't seem to be a study to back that right now. That was an announcement. That was a press release. That's different than a journal article. So we do like to see those journal articles. Go ahead and send one to us, and I'll make sure she looks at it for you, okay? This is Kilo Golf 7, Golf Delta Bravo, and we have the Emergency Preparedness Net. And are there any more questions? Okay, if you don't have any questions offhand, maybe she can let her talk a little bit about vaccines, since that seems to be in the news right now, and how we get vaccines.
So obviously we all want a vaccine, right? That's the thing that's going to allow everybody to go back to doing all the things that they love. I'm a little nervous. Maybe it's because I've seen some vaccine complications in the past. I used to do neurology, and there was a swine flu vaccine that caused Guillain-Barré, which is a whole body paralysis thing, which is horrible. There's been a number of viruses vaccines for viruses that they have tried, like for a thing in the tropics called dengue fever, that they found out, lo and behold, that the people that were vaccinated and then later exposed to it actually got sicker instead of better. So I want a virus, I want a vaccine for this virus, but I don't want them to speed it up enough to make it unsafe, because you won't know that it's unsafe until you do it to a lot of people. So looking at the vaccines, the traditional vaccines always had some kind of inactive disease. Originally, they killed the live bug and injected in you, and then they put the dead bug in you, and then they put parts of the dead bug into you. They were always something having to do with giving you part of a virus or a bacteria that would then make your body develop immunity to it, and hopefully you wouldn't get sick in the process, particularly if they were just giving you part of a organism. The new research that you're hearing about right now with this vaccine that they were talking about, that they've done a whopping 8 patients on so far, is a brand new kind of vaccine. They have never done a vaccine of this type before. It's something called mRNA, and basically, you have your DNA in the nucleus of your cell, and your DNA tells your cell how to do everything. And the way it does that is the DNA makes something called mRNA in the nucleus, and then the mRNA goes out to the protein-making factories in a cell body, and they make the protein. So these new viruses are actually giving you mRNA with a trick for your human cells to pick up this mRNA. And the mRNA is not part of what you would normally have, but it's an mRNA that makes a protein that looks like a piece of the virus. And so you're basically turning your cells into little factories to make pieces of virus. Now, you're not going to get infected from it. I'm just weirded out a little bit about the fact that we're injecting something that's going to actually change the way our cells actually make proteins. And it doesn't mean it's not going to be great. It's easy, it's fast, it's cheap, but it is something that has never been tried for a vaccine before. So, that's kind of what a virus does, actually. When a virus attacks you, it goes into your cell, and it takes over your cellular mechanisms to make more virus. So in this case, we're taking over the cellular mechanism to make something that looks like a piece of virus. Again, I don't think you'll be infected, but I just would like to know a lot more about safety. So far, they've only used mRNA before in oncology, where they take a tumor from somebody, they develop mRNA from a piece of that tumor, something that looks like that tumor, and then they inject it back in the patient and have their immune system hopefully attack the tumor. But that's the only human studies that's been used in this new technique. So just so you know, that's what we're looking at with this new thing that they've tried in 8 people and they say is going to be safe and wonderful. Maybe it will, maybe it won't, but I would like really huge tests, and I don't want them to speed it up so much that we end up injecting a large portion of the world with something that we haven't proven is safe, both in the short term and in the long term. The other concerns I have about making sure that our vaccine work is done carefully and safely is that doing vaccines in general has been a problem because a lot of times a vaccine can actually turn on your immune system too much. So like I said, with dengue fever, it found out that people that were vaccinated and then exposed to it, they actually turned on a huge immune response that made them really sick. And so far, one of the things that's bad about COVID is that we know, like, the second really severe part of the illness when you have to go in the hospital and you have respiratory failure and all these things go wrong in all your body, that a large part of that is actually not the virus anymore. It's the immune response to the virus. The same thing with this new pediatric symptom thing that you're hearing about with this multi-system inflammatory thing that we're seeing in kids. That's not the virus. That is an overactive immune system. And since we also know that vaccines sometimes cause overactive immune system problems, that Guillain-Barré I mentioned, that's the same thing. Again, I just want to make sure that we don't speed up a vaccine process too fast so that we're not taking time to make sure that it's really safe. And as you read these studies, think about that. Make sure you're asking, how does this virus work? Has it really been checked to be safe before anybody starts pushing it through from a political or a business agenda to start giving it to everybody?
Okay, there are questions about vaccines. That's a huge topic. We haven't really covered it. There's quite a bit of technical information there. So if you, didn't follow the news, a drug company announced that they have they were in phase one clinical trials and they have an announcement of a result, but it's not, the trial is not complete. It's an early result on 8 patients showing that they mounted an immune response. That's all we have. And so we're talking about a totally new way of doing a vaccine that we haven't done before, and we don't really have a paper to back it up yet to see exactly what they've done. But everybody has an interest in getting this to happen, and they did release a lot of stock, apparently, at the same time that they made the announcements, and they want funding so they can develop this stuff. So, are they looking for funding, or are they really have results? That's kind of the question we have to ask ourselves. So do you have any questions about vaccine development or how it works or anything you've heard so far?
One other question, K6STX.
Yeah, sure, Dan. Go ahead, please.
Well, I brought this up last time, so I'm looking for maybe an update. What about children? Is this thing something different that's gotten into the children, or have they got that thing figured out as what's causing this, or is it still really part of this virus?
So I assume you're talking about this Kawasaki type thing, which now has an official name. It's MIS-C for multi-system inflammatory syndrome in children. It is an immune reaction, okay? It's what we would consider an autoimmune response. And we know, particularly in kids for some reason, but also in adults, that certain infections in the past trigger your immune system to do crazy things. And we're not always sure why that happens. Sometimes we think that, your immune system gears up about the virus and it's just so overactive it starts attacking everything. Sometimes it sees some similarities between the virus and something that is normal in a human. So autoimmune diseases are a whole slew of diseases. But we have seen, particularly in kids, this happen with illnesses before, where they get a virus or a bacteria, they fight that off without any problem. You don't even know if they've necessarily been sick. But then their immune system continues to stay in overdrive, and in this case, that's exactly what's happening. The immune system is attacking blood vessels in organs throughout their body and often causing, you know, heart damage, neurologic damage, blood bone marrow problems, all kinds of things that seem to all be coming about from an overactive immune system triggered by a virus infection sometime in the previous 4 weeks. But the virus isn't doing this anymore. They're not infected with the virus at this time. It's just that the virus infection at some point in time a few weeks ago, many of whom were probably asymptomatic, has triggered this overactive immune response. It's not unheard of, but it's generally very rare. We just know it's happening a lot more frequently now than we normally see, and that's why we can link it to COVID.
KCD on Echo Link.
Okay, Kilo 7, Juliet, Charlie, Delta, John, welcome. Do you have a question?
Yeah, I'm with Sheila. I don't trust these vaccines right now. But I'd like to know what's the status of treatment development, therapeutics.
I do want to point out that in general, I am not an anti-vaxxer. I am very much a pro-vaccination person. But that's because our standard vaccines have been studied up the wazoo, and I am 100% capable that confident that they are safe. What I am against is a virus that we do too quickly and too widely used before we really understand what we're doing. So I want to make sure that's really clear in everybody's mind, because I believe strongly in vaccines. I just don't want our anxiety about wanting life to get back to normal to cause us to bypass what we normally would do to make sure a vaccine is safe. As far as treatments, it's not great. The remdesivir medication has shown some partial benefit. They have a stockpile of it, which they have distributed around the country with some difficulties, just like most other things that we've tried to distribute around the country. But it's finally starting to arrive, and I think actually Marion County has some of it. The intent is to use it with people that are seriously ill, but early in the course of their serious illness, because we think it shortens the amount of time that they are seriously ill and improves the odds that they will make it through. And so that's our best therapeutic right now, and it's still in limited supply. The rest of what we're doing is still basically just good old-fashioned supportive care for people that are sick. The good news is that we're getting a lot better of it, as because we've had many, many more people to treat, so we have all these things about positioning and monitoring oxygen and a variety of things like that that are making us do consistently better at treating the symptom load while people get through the illness on their own. But that's not actually treating the virus. We really haven't made any progress in that other than this little bit of remdesivir thing.
Yeah, Richard, go ahead. Okay, I'm going to repeat that for the good of the recording there. Yeah, Richard's asking about plasma donations. It's actually the platelet donations that went on, right?
Plasma
therapy for people who have had COVID and survived. You know, they'll go to people that have had the illness, and supposedly they've got the goodies in their plasma, which would help fight off the disease. So I'm going to have Sheila checking that data out right now.
So I know there are a number of places that are doing it as far as a strategy and a testing thing. So there's a number of different hospitals that are doing it. I think they've reached the point where they've decided that it's safe to give convalescent plasma, which is always important. Again, when we're trying a bunch of stuff really fast, the first thing is to make sure that we're keeping everybody safe when we do it. So we've reached the point where we think blood plasma seems to be safe. We are not to the point yet where we know whether it's going to do any good. But that's, those studies are happening in a number of different places, and I'm guessing maybe within 2 weeks we might start having some good preliminary data on that.
Okay, so there we go. Now, there's one question that nobody really asked. Now, this repeater, of course, covers 11 counties, and we really are lots of people. But you might have noticed that there are some counties that applied to go to phase one of reopening, and Marion and Polk County and Multnomah County did not make the cut. So why is that? And so I was going to, I had that question, and Sheila looked up that answer. So maybe you'd like to know why not Marion County?
Well, actually, it's Marion and Polk County here, and then the three Portland counties. The three Portland counties didn't even ask for permission to open last week, but two of them are going to ask for permission this week. I don't know whether they'll get it or not. But as for what happened in Marion County is that we've actually had a recent increase in the number of cases again in Marion County, as well as we had a spike in the number of hospitalizations. I think we had like 7 hospitalizations in one day. That looks like it may have been a little statistical outlier, but the increase in cases is real, and it's been an ongoing problem with Marion County. If you actually look at counties with the highest incidence per population, we're not only one of the worst in Oregon, we're one of the worst in the country. We have a high number of cases in Marion County per population, particularly considering that we're not testing all that much. The interesting thing is that if you break it down by zip codes, most of our cases are coming from Woodburn, Jervis, Hubbard area. And our county health department has said that they can't figure out where they're coming from, but it doesn't take a genius to realize that those are very heavy agricultural zip codes. And there have been a lot of reports about increasing amounts of COVID being found in agricultural communities, from farm workers that are living together in hotels or in bunks to people that are working in the fields without adequate social distancing, particularly doing crops that require several people doing one thing at a time. And then they go home and they live in the community and they bring it back to their families, and then their families continue to spread it out through the community. So it's pretty suspicious that in Marion County it is very heavily agricultural zip codes that seem to be the cause of it. But so far, Marion County is also falling behind the eight ball in terms of our contact testing. So when we get a positive, somebody's supposed to go out there from public health and figure out everybody that they came in contact with and then follow all of those people. And we've not been very good at that so far. In fact, we're so far behind that the state has just decided to loan us contact tracers because we just can't seem to manage to do what everybody else is doing. So that's Marion County. Polk County's problem is that we had a really bad outbreak at Orchard Heights, which is a nursing facility in Polk County. It's actually a pretty nasty one with like 50-some cases and I believe 7 deaths. And that was enough to make Polk County have a sudden increase. So what's going to happen next? Marion County is trying to convince the state that they've got more contact tracers, that the numbers were just a transient blip. And the state is really leaning towards letting counties open. So I suspect Marion County will get approved for phase one this week or next. To me, that is not comforting because I consider Marion County still probably the highest risk area in Oregon. So, take what you will from that.
Okay, and with that, it's Kilo Golf 7, Golf Delta Bravo. It's 8:04, and I don't want to keep people too long. Is there, you know, the last comment or question, and then we need to close the net down. Okay. well, hearing nothing there, let's, the time is now 8.04 p.m. This concludes the 529 Emergency Preparedness Net. Again, there will be a recording available of today's discussion on the WA7ABU groups.io page. This net meets each Tuesday evening at 7 p.m. on 145.29 MHz. Our thanks go out to Dan, WA7ABU, for the use of the repeater. Thank you to our guests, Sheila Sund, MD. Thank you to all who participated today, those who stood by to give us a clear channel. This is Kilo Golf 7, Golf Delta Bravo, now closing in at 8.05 p.m. We now return the repeater to normal, undirected amateur operations. KG7, GDB, clear.